This morning, as we complete Paul's third missionary journey in Acts chapter 20, it's time for us to take a little detour concerning what's going on at this particular time with Paul. We saw last week how he had spent almost 3 years in Ephesus, and that was sort of capstoned or ended with a great riot that finally breaks out in the city by those who both worship the goddess Diana or Artemis at that great temple that was there in Ephesus, and those who financially profited by that worship. And Paul's work had been so effective in Ephesus that worship was falling off. Spending was falling off. Business was falling off. And so people became agitated enough that they resorted to the one thing they had that would prove effective, and that's violence against Paul and the Christians. But maybe we should ask a question of why did Paul spend so long in Ephesus? Next week we hope to spend some time talking about the fact that Paul is also entering in during this period of his third missionary journey. He is entering into that period of time in which he becomes an author. He becomes the apostle of the epistles, shall we say. And it's while he's at Ephesus, among other things, that he writes two letters to the Corinthians, and which are our 1st and 2nd Corinthians. And so some of the insight we have into what was going on at Ephesus comes from reading those letters. We mostly think of the letters to the Corinthians as a matter of correcting problems they were having and teaching them things they needed to know. But Paul also lets them know about what's happening with him there in Ephesus. And so in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, he tells them at the end of this letter, 1 Corinthians 16, in verse 8 and 9, he says, "But I will stay on at Ephesus until Pentecost." Now he's telling them that he's looking forward to visiting them soon. And we'll get into more of that both later in this lesson and the one next week of why he wants to visit them. But he says, "But I will stay on at Ephesus until Pentecost, because a great door for effective work has opened to me, and there are many who oppose me." The reason Paul stayed so long at Ephesus is because a great door of opportunity had opened up. And as long as that door was open in Ephesus, and through Ephesus the work in all of Asia, that region, that southwestern part of modern Turkey that was called Asia in New Testament times, he was going to stay there and work. But when that work was complete, not that he had done all that could be done, but when he had done all that his charge as an apostle called on him to do, then he would leave. And therefore, we hear him writing to the Romans in chapter 15. Once he leaves Ephesus, as we'll read this morning in chapter 20 of Acts, he will cross over to Macedonia and then down into Achaia, so he'll visit Philippi, Thessalonica, probably Berea, though we don't know for sure, and eventually end up back in Corinth and spend 3 months with them. And while he's in Corinth, or perhaps when he's back up visiting Philippi one last time, one of those two places, he writes a letter to the Christians in Rome. And so here's our letter to the Romans. Again, in this letter, he gives us some insight into what's going on with him during this time. And so in Romans 15, after he's left Ephesus, gone to Corinth, he writes the letter to the Romans and he says this, Romans chapter 15 and verse 23, "But now that there is no more place for me to work in these regions, and since I have been longing for many years to see you, I plan to do so when I go to Spain." So, first of all, Paul tells the Corinthians that he stayed in Ephesus as long as he did because a great door of opportunity was open. And then after he leaves Ephesus and is visiting Corinth for the last time, as far as we know, he writes to the Romans and he tells them that there is no more place for me to work in these regions. What did he mean by that? I do not believe he was saying that all the doors are closed. I don't believe he was saying no one will receive me anymore. I think instead he's saying that he has fulfilled his commission to this part of the world. Remember, his commission was the Great Commission. And while Jesus didn't give it to him specifically in Matthew 28, 19 and 20, like he did the other 12, or in Mark 16, 15 and 16, like he did the other 12, or actually the 11 at that point, he did give it to him on the road to Damascus. And Paul always saw his job as being is to preach the gospel where it was not yet known. Not to feel like he needed to stay at a place long after the gospel had already been preached there. And so that's why, even though he'll come back around and keep visiting these places he had preached earlier, he didn't choose to stay. He'll go back and visit in Antioch. He'll go back and visit in Lyconium and Derbe on three different, he was there three different times. He will visit at Troas twice. He will visit in Philippi three times, Corinth at least twice we know of. And yet, after the first time he was in all those places, he would not stay because he had already fulfilled his commission there. But there were still plenty of other places that he needed to go. And so even as he writes to the Romans from Corinth on that last visit to Corinth, he tells the Romans that I look forward to seeing you. I've been wanting for a long time to come there. However, it was not his dream, it seems, to come preach the gospel in Rome because the gospel had already been preached there by others. Instead, what does he say? I hope to visit you on my way to Spain. There's somewhere the gospel hadn't been preached yet. So his sights are now set on Spain. But he has some other work to do first. He has to go to Jerusalem and deliver a gift. While he was here in Ephesus, it was a matter of power against power. This door of opportunity was the opportunity to show the power of God over the power of evil. We saw it in the text itself in chapter 19, where Paul healed people. Ephesus was a place where many people from all over the Roman world believed they could come and find healing in some of the magic and other things that were practiced there. And even by going up to the temple of Diana, there were many who professed that they had been healed by visiting there. And yet, Paul showed the real power of God to really heal people. People were great believers in spirits and the supernatural and the invisible world in Ephesus. The preaching of the gospel there by Paul was somewhat humorously illustrated as superior to these spirits when these Jewish exorcist started trying to use the name of Paul and the name of Jesus to cast spirits out of people and ended up being beaten up and had to flee for their life because the Spirit said to them, Jesus I know and Paul I know, but who are you? Showing that whatever power they had claimed to have over spirits was really worthless. Only the power that Jesus had and that Paul had spoken of had the power to control the supernatural forces. It was a power of God to change people because a great number of those who had come to faith in Jesus Christ not only left those magic arts and that superstition that they'd been a part of, but they, even some of them who had been practicing it as a way of living, making a living, brought their magic books and all of those things and made great piles of them. They were burned publicly. This not only was their way of saying, we're done with this, but it was their way of telling the whole city of Ephesus that these people are saying, this is worthless. This has no power as compared to the power of God and of Jesus Christ. And the mere fact that the worshiping of Diana was falling off so drastically and dramatically in the city, and the financial impact on those who made their living around the temple had fallen off so dramatically, is itself a testimony to the power of the gospel, isn't it? Fewer people were worshiping there. They were now worshiping Jesus and God. Fewer people were spending their money on these trinkets and silver things that Demetrius and the others were making and selling people as if they had some kind of magical or mystical properties. They weren't spending their money on that anymore because they had discovered that had no power. Only the power of Jesus did. And that it all dropped off so precipitously that even this riot was proof of the power of God over the power of the spirits of this dark world. Later, when Paul will write back to the Christians in Ephesus in his letter to the Ephesians, he will, in chapter 2, talk about how they had all been at one time under the influence of the forces of this dark world. Look with me at that in Ephesians chapter 2. He says in Ephesians 2:1, "As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world and the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is still at work in those who are disobedient." So he says they at one time were under the power of the one who controlled this dark world. And then in chapter 6, as he's talking to them about putting on the armor of God, he's using an image that would be very clear to them. Everywhere you looked in Ephesus, there were Roman soldiers. Not only was it a popular place for soldiers to come when they were on leave, but their large contingent was actually stationed there. It was the headquarters for Roman authority in all of Asia. So you saw Roman soldiers everywhere, and he uses that imagery to talk about what they as Christians should do, putting on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. That's what he had been battling against when he was in Ephesus, and that's what the Christians who were there when he writes this letter back to them, we're still fighting against. But now, call to your attention what we read earlier when he told the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 9. He did say that he had stayed at Ephesus so long because there was a great door of opportunity, but he also said, "But there are many who oppose me." Luke, when he writes his history of this time in Paul's ministry, gives us a very brief overview of what was going on. It's Paul himself who gives us a lot more detail about what's going on in Ephesus. Yes, a great door of opportunity. Spends over 2 years teaching in the hall of Tyrannus so that the gospel is heard not only throughout all of Ephesus, but throughout all of Asia. Churches are established all over Asia. The seven churches of Asia we keep referring to in Revelation chapters 2 and 3, apparently most or all of them came into existence during this time that Paul is preaching in Ephesus because of his work. So yes, it was a great door of opportunity, but there was also great danger involved. Paul also, when he wrote to the Corinthians, says this in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, as he writes to the Corinthians from Ephesus, while he's still there, about the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, and he's trying to, in this great chapter, 1 Corinthians 15, help them understand fully and completely the truth of the resurrection of Jesus and what it really meant. He says this down near the end of that chapter. 1 Corinthians 15:31, "I die every day." He's in Ephesus. He's working hard. They're having great success. And yet he says, "I die every day." He's not using that in the literal sense, but in the sense that every day he faces death for what he's doing. There's great danger. Long before that riot, he faced great danger daily in Ephesus. "I die every day. I mean that, brothers, just as surely as I glory over you in Christ Jesus our Lord. If I fought wild beast in Ephesus for merely human reasons, what have I gained? If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." Paul says, why would I face not just death every day, but even, as he puts it here, "I fought wild beasts in Ephesus." Some think that it might have actually come down to Paul being one of the first Christians we have a record of having been put in the arena in Ephesus, along with the gladiators and the wild beast, because of his faith. Others think that instead of it talking about that, he's actually using this idea of wild beast to mean the vicious attacks by the enemies of the cross while he was in Ephesus. We don't know for sure which he had in mind. But Paul lets us know more than Luke does, that he faced great danger during this time that he was there. If we go back to chapter 4 of 1 Corinthians, he describes something of the way he was treated, by some at least, while he was in Ephesus. For he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, and maybe we can just start in verse 10, he says, "We are fools for Christ." Many people in Ephesus treated him and those who had come to follow the teaching of the gospel as being fools. And they don't mean foolish, the way we use that term. They mean in the sense that these people are totally stark, raving mad. These people have lost their minds. That's how they were being treated by some. "We are fools for Christ, but you are so wise in Christ. We are weak, but you are strong. You are honored. We are dishonored to this very hour." And in other words, he's saying, even as I'm writing this, and where is he? Again, he's in Ephesus during this 3-year period. "To this very hour, we go hungry and thirsty. We are in rags. We are brutally treated. We are homeless. We work hard with our own hands. When we are cursed, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure it. When we are slandered, we answer kindly. Up to this moment, we have become the scum of the earth, the refuse of the world." The work in Ephesus, while fruitful, was not easy. It took everything Paul had in him, all the faith, all the courage, all the endurance, to stay there and do the work. For he's not only facing death every day, he's being cursed and mistreated, he's without, and so are those who are with him. So are those that are one to Christ. Can you imagine preaching the gospel to somebody who says, Come, hear the gospel. Let me tell you what the gospel is going to do for you. It's going to make you homeless and hungry and without clothes and without friends. You're going to be treated like the scum of the earth. Won't you come? Let's extend the invitation. You'd think nobody would come forward under those circumstances. And yet it was what they were getting when they heard the gospel, not what they were losing, that won people. Yes, they were losing a lot. They were also gaining eternal life and right relationship with God. In his second letter to the Corinthians, it was written just a few months after the first one, he says this, 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 8, again, talking about what's going on in Ephesus that Luke doesn't mention to us. In 2 Corinthians 1 and verse 8, "We do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about the hardships we suffered in the province of Asia." Ephesus was the capital of Asia. "We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life. Indeed, in our hearts, we felt the sentence of death. But this happened that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God, who raises the dead. He has delivered us from such a deadly peril, and He will deliver us. On Him we have set our hope, that He will continue to deliver us as you help us by your prayers." The work in Ephesus was tough. We shouldn't think that when he said that it was an open door of opportunity, that it was just a matter of every Sunday they announced that they were going to be speaking in the church building and people were overflowing the doors. It was, along with the great success of that work, there was this right on the edge of a knife all the time. Facing of death daily, doing without, of almost the very necessities of life, even while he's doing it. It all wraps up when we go back to Acts chapter 20 with that riot. It's clear by then to Paul, not because of the riot, but because of what he's accomplished. He's now fulfilled his mission in Ephesus. It's now clear it's time to go. And so chapter 20 of Acts begins. "When the uproar had ended, Paul sent for the disciples and after encouraging them, said goodbye and set out for Macedonia. He traveled through that area, speaking many words of encouragement to the people, and finally arrived in Greece, where he stayed 3 months." That would be Corinth. "Because the Jews made a plot against him just as he was about to sail for Syria, he decided to go back through Macedonia. And he was accompanied by Sopater, son of Pyrrhus from Berea, Aristarchus and Secundus from Thessalonica, Gaius from Derbe, Timothy also, and from the province of Asia, Tychicus and Trophimus. These men went on ahead and waited for us at Troas. But we sailed from Philippi after the feast of unleavened bread, and 5 days later joined the others at Troas, where we stayed 7 days. Again, Luke's primary purpose is sort of sketch out the spread of the gospel throughout the Roman Empire, and it will end up in Rome. That's why Acts ends in Rome. And by necessity, he was often very sketchy or very brief in describing some of the things that happened. So we find here that Paul leaves Ephesus, and he apparently either caught a ship in Ephesus or went up to Troas and caught a ship and sailed over to Macedonia, just like he had done on his second missionary journey, which means he would then visit Philippi, come down and visit Thessalonica, and then Berea. And then if he followed the same pattern, probably pass through Athens, where there were apparently very few Christians. He had had very little success there. And go on into Greece proper, into the leading city of all of Greece at that time, which would be Corinth, where he spends 3 months. And then it says that it was his decision at this time that he wanted to go from there to Syria. Now, that's exactly what he had done at the end of his second missionary journey. When he had left Corinth, he had gone down and caught a ship and had sailed from there to Caesarea and on down to Jerusalem. But now when he determined to do it this time, he found out there was a plot among the Jews in Corinth, the same ones that he had had trouble with the first time he was there, a plot to kill him. And apparently somehow the plot involved killing him while he was on board a ship, if he sailed straight from Corinth. And so plans are changed. He decides to retrace his route back up through at least Thessalonica and Philippi, and then sail from Philippi back over to Troas and go that route. That, you know, he avoids the trap that way, the plot. But there's an elephant in the room we're not talking about here. Even as Luke tells us all these things about Paul leaving Ephesus and going over into Macedonia and then down to Achaia and Corinth, and then from there wanted to sail to Syria, meaning Caesarea, and from there would go down to Jerusalem. He doesn't tell us why Paul wants to do all that. He doesn't tell us why. And here's the reason why. Again, we turn to Paul's letters to the Corinthians and to the Romans, these letters that were written during this period of time, to tell us what else is going on. When Paul, after his first missionary journey, had gone back down to Jerusalem. We have to go all the way back to Acts 15. When he had gone back down to Jerusalem with Barnabas, after the conclusion of his first missionary journey, that had that big discussion about what do Jewish Christians have to do and what should Gentile Christians do. Remember that? And while Jewish Christians were continuing to practice circumcision and apparently even keeping the Sabbath day and many of their dietary laws and so forth that they had lived with all of their life as Jews, and they were continuing to practice that even as Christians, we find out they had the right to do that under the banner of what's called Christian liberty, as long as they did not make that something that they saw as a necessity to be right with God. They had the right to not eat pork. They had the right to not work on the Sabbath day. They had the right to circumcise their children as Christians, as long as they never got it in their mind that this was a necessity to please God. They could continue to practice their Jewishness. Now, when they started saying Gentiles had to do it also, the only reason you could say that a Gentile had to do it as a Christian is if you were saying that it was necessary to please God. And that's why they had that meeting in Acts chapter 15. And it was clearly decided by the apostles and the elders of the church in Jerusalem and under the guidance of the Holy Spirit that that is not what Gentile Christians had to do. Well, that created some tension. The tension already existed, but the tension continued to exist after this between those who were Jewish Christians and those who were Gentile Christians. There was a certain level of fear and suspicion The Jewish Christians probably felt like the Gentile Christians weren't holy enough because they weren't practicing as many religious kind of things as the Jewish Christians were. There was fear and there was suspicion, and there, most of all, there was just ignorance of each other and what each other believed and how they had all come to Christ basically the same way and were living for Christ the same way. But there was one other thing that happened while Paul was there in Jerusalem in Acts 15. It's not recorded in Acts 15, but over in Galatians chapter 2, Galatians is possibly the first letter Paul wrote. And he wrote it not too very long after Acts 15 took place, it seems at least. And as he's writing that, he's writing to the Galatians in chapter 2 and verse 10 and telling them about this meeting that he's been a part of in Acts 15. And he says to them in Galatians 2 and in verse 9, James, Peter, and John, those reputed to be pillars, gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship when they recognized the grace given to me. They agreed that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the Jews. So he's just saying that meeting broke up with James, the brother of Jesus, one of the elders of the church there, along with Peter and John, two of the apostles, and probably the most outstanding in terms of us knowing them there, all extending to Paul and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship, saying, you're doing a right work and a good work among the Gentiles. You should continue to do that. But Paul said they did mention one thing to him in verse 10. All they asked was that we should continue to remember the poor, which we were very eager to do. As he was about to leave Jerusalem, this is again at the end of his first missionary journey when he'd gone down there, the brethren there said, please remember the poor among us. You might recall that there was that time just earlier when Paul and Barnabas, when they were first working with the church up in Antioch in chapter 13, had actually helped spearhead a contribution in Antioch to be taken down to the church in Jerusalem to help the needy Christians there. Now, a few chapters later, in Acts 15, recorded in Galatians 2, we find that the brethren in Jerusalem are still reminding Paul and Barnabas that they still have needy there. Why was the church so needy in Jerusalem? Remember in the very early days of the church in Jerusalem, in Acts chapter 2 and 3 and 4, how as people were coming into the church, people were taking their property and their possessions and selling them and bringing them and laying at the feet of the apostles so the needs of those who had nothing could be met? The church in Jerusalem in its very earliest days had, its members had impoverished themselves to meet the needs of their brothers and sisters. And then something else happened. According to the writer of Hebrews in Hebrews chapter 10, who is writing to Jewish Christians, perhaps even those in Jerusalem, mentions that they in the early days had stood side by side with those who were persecuted for the faith, and those who had been imprisoned for their faith. Remember, that would be the days of Paul, back when he was Saul and actually arresting people and carrying them off to prison. And the writer in Hebrews chapter 10 says, you stood side by side with those people who were being imprisoned, and you joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property. So the ones who hadn't sold their property and given the money to the apostles so they could help the needy among them, later, when the persecution broke out, had their property taken away from them. And so you end up with a large number of Christians in and around Jerusalem who are impoverished. They don't have property. They've lost or given up one or the other what they had. By the time we get to Acts 13, a famine breaks out in that part of the world, and they didn't have the resources to take care of themselves adequately. That's why the church up in Antioch had been so generous into sending a great deal of support down them to help the Christians. This wasn't in order to keep the lights on in the church building or to pay the preacher. This was to feed the needy among the Christians. And now they tell Paul in Acts 15, as it's recorded in Galatians 2, to be sure and keep on remembering the poor among us. And Paul's going to do that. He spent 2 years, almost 3 years in Ephesus, but while he's in Ephesus these 3 years, preaching the gospel, suffering, feeling like he's facing the sentence of death on many, many days, he's doing one more thing. He is organizing an expansive, a large contribution among all the churches that he's a part of that might be taken back down to Jerusalem one more time for the Christians down there. Luke scarcely even mentions it to us because that's not what he's writing about primarily. But Paul himself tells us about it as he's writing to the Corinthians. And so in our passage, it was read at the beginning of the service this morning in 1 Corinthians 16. Paul is in Ephesus. He's writing over to the church in Corinth. And he says, now, about the collection for God's people. What is he talking about? He's talking about a contribution that he is helping organize to be taken down to the church in Jerusalem, in Judea, to once more meet the needs of those impoverished Christians there. Now, about the collection for God's people, do what I told the Galatian churches to do. So, he's not only telling the Corinthians to do this, he says, I've also told the Galatian churches to do this. On the first day of every week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with his income, saving it up so that when I come, no collections will have to be made. Then when I arrive, I will give letters of introduction to the men you approve and send them with your gift to Jerusalem. And if it seems advisable for me to go also, they will accompany me. So he's given here instructions to them. Probably he had already sent them by word of mouth through Titus or Timothy or Silas or Apollos or someone else who had been going back and forth between Paul in Ephesus and the church in Corinth. But now he's putting it in a letter to them. And he tells them that on the first day of every week, why on the first day of the week? Because that's when the Christians met. That's been a tradition from this period of time in history up until today that Christians meet on the first day of the week in celebration of the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And so while they come together on the first day of the week, they were to set aside, each one of them, a sum of money and build this collection so that when he finally does come to them, it will have already been accomplished. They won't suddenly be scrambling to everybody try to get some money together once he arrives. They do it before he ever arrives. He talks about this more in his second letter to them that's written just a few months later. Two whole chapters. 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and chapter 9 is devoted to talking about this contribution. Not so much what it's for, but what kind of an attitude the Corinthians ought to have about it. And it gives us more insight also into who all was participating in it and what it was for. And so he says in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 1, and now, brothers, we want you to know about the grace that God has given the Macedonian churches. Remember, at that time, the northern part of Greece was called Macedonia. That's where the churches of Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea were located. At least those three, and maybe more. We don't have named. And so he says, I want to tell you about what God is doing among the Macedonian churches. Out of the most severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able and even beyond their ability. Entirely on their own, they urgently pleaded with us for the privilege of sharing in this service to the saints. So the contribution is not only being taken up among the Galatian churches. These would be churches off to the east of Ephesus in Asia. Not only are they taking up in churches like in Corinth, which is in Achaia, but it's being taken up in the churches in Macedonia. Eventually, we'll even see, I think clearly, that it was also being taken up right there in the church in Ephesus as well. Because when Luke was listing all those people who were going to go with Paul on this journey, at least one of them was a person from Ephesus. He would be the representative from the church there carrying their gift. Because that was Paul's plan, wasn't it? Not that he carry all this money down to Jerusalem, but that each church would appoint a man or men who would be their representative to carry their part of the money. And they'd all travel together to Jerusalem and all together present this to the church down there. So he talks to them about the churches up in Macedonia and what they're doing. And so he's using that example to urge the Christians in Corinth to be like-minded, to be also generous in what they're doing and be diligent about being generous in all of this. And there's just so much more we could say about it, because as we read through chapters 8 and 9, we hear Paul's encouragements to them of what kind of motivation should be involved in this giving. But we do have to go back and look once more at that passage over in Romans 15 we read earlier. Because again, he writes to the Romans while he's in Corinth finishing up this business of the contribution. And while he's there in Corinth, as we read in Acts 20, he writes to the church in Rome. And at the end of that letter, not only does he tell them in Romans 15:23 that there's no more place for me in this area, in this region, and I look to visit you on my way to Spain, but he says this also, why he can't come immediately to them in verse 25 of Romans 15. Now, however, I am on my way to Jerusalem in the service of the saints. That's exactly the same expression that was used there in 2 Corinthians 8 to describe the Macedonian Christians being involved in the service to the saints. He's talking about this contribution. He says, verse 26, for Macedonia and Achaia were pleased to make a contribution for the poor among the saints in Jerusalem. They were pleased to do it, and indeed they owe it to them. For if the Gentiles have shared in the Jews' spiritual blessings, they owe it to the Jews to share with them their material blessings. So after I have completed this task and have made sure that they have received this fruit, I will go to Spain and visit you on the way. Paul saw this great contribution that was being put together, and we have no idea how much money was actually collected, how much value was attached to it. We just know that a large number of churches were involved in it. Churches in Galatia, churches in Asia, churches in Macedonia, and churches in Achaia. But we do know that he said that this is what the churches owed to the Jewish Christians, because the gospel had come from the Jews. It was the church in Jerusalem that had sent out the gospel, including Paul. And in return, it's only fair that the Gentiles, who have benefited so much from this blessing from the Jews, show some reciprocity, some equality, by making sure that their needs are met as well. The Gentiles weren't broke financially. They were broke spiritually. They were impoverished spiritually, and from the Jews they learned about the grace of God and Jesus Christ and had become Christians. But it's the Jews who are spiritually rich who are financially poor. And so the Gentile Christians can help them in that way. And so Paul lists a whole number of reasons in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 about what's going to come out of this giving. Not only will the needs of the people be met, but they'll be more united, they'll love each other more. Prayers will go up from the Jewish Christians thanking God for the Gentile Christians. That's something that might not have been happening too much up until then, because of this fear and ignorance that existed between the Jewish Christians and the Gentile Christians. But when the Gentile Christian would be so generous to help them out in a time of great need, suddenly the Jewish Christians would feel much more connected with the Gentile Christians and realize these people love us and love the same things we love, and they're trying to help us. Not because they, in a sense, owe us anything, but because they recognize we are brothers and sisters in faith. Now, we know that it's out of this great example of giving that what we do in giving finds its beginning. When we talk about taking up a collection on the first day of the week, we look at this passage, don't we? Even though it was talking about a specific need that was being met, we use that as an example of what we do every Sunday. And when we talk about how people should give, it's not a tithe, because we're not commanded to give 10% or 30% or whatever of our giving, but we're to give as we're able. Those who had much gave much. Those who had little gave little. And the funds that were being given to meet the needs of those in need and to advance the cause of the kingdom. We have other examples where, while we don't know the specifics of how it was done, Paul mentions how once and again the church in Philippi had taken monies and sent them to him so he could preach the gospel. And so we do the same today. It's a very valuable, insightful part of the scriptures. And it's all happening right now as Paul is finishing up his third missionary journey. He's overseeing this great contribution. And so when he goes finally to Jerusalem, he'll be accompanied by quite a large number of other people, representatives from the various congregations, each one of them carrying their own bag of resources to be given to the church there. And Paul said even that was done so that in every way this might be considered honorable and honest and without question in the sight of anybody. If Paul just went around to every church and said, okay, give me the money, I'll take it while I go, we know or we believe we could trust Paul. But there would always be those critics who would say, yeah, what's he going to do with that money? Did he skim a little off the top, or did he carry it all to Jerusalem with him? Was he just doing this because he wanted to financially profit from this? So he would have none of it. As far as we know, he didn't carry a dime of the money. But individuals from every congregation instead, traveling with him, carried it themselves. And they could always go back to their home congregation when they were finished and say, yes, I delivered our money to the elders in Jerusalem. Paul had nothing to do with it. I did it. I did just what you commissioned me to do. And so, Paul was already under attack by various critics in the church who were Judaizers, mostly those who were trying to take the Gentiles back to Judaism, about him trying to create his own little kingdom or other kind of things like that. He was not going to give them another opportunity for criticism. A great, great part of the Scriptures. Sorry I'm going on as long as I have about it, but we need to realize how very much of what we know and understand about our own giving comes out of this particular set of instances in the Scriptures.